I'd like to take your Bibles this morning and turn to the book of Psalms, Psalm 100. Psalm 100. Shout joyfully to Yahweh, all the earth. Serve Yahweh with gladness. Come before Him with joyful singing. Know that Yahweh Himself is God. It is He who has made us, and not we ourselves. We are His people and the sheep of His pasture. Enter His gates with thanksgiving, and His courts with praise. Give thanks to Him. Bless His name. For Yahweh is good. His loving kindness is everlasting, and His faithfulness to all generations. I chose this psalm because of specifically all five verses apply to the sermon this morning, but especially verse 4, obviously, where it says, enter His gates with thanksgiving and His courts with praise. And you know, I'm convinced, especially after studying and researching in the scriptures concerning this particular message, I'm absolutely convinced that we have lost. One of the reasons I chose to sing the song Faith of Our Fathers this morning and beginning our service was also for this reason, because we have lost not only the faith of our fathers in so many ways, not only the conviction and the commitment of our fathers, but we've lost even how to be thankful to our God, how to praise our God. I went through so many passages in the Old Testament where they had literally set up, they wanted to make sure that God got His due when it came to praise and thanksgiving. That David and the others, when it came to the sanctuary, or even the tabernacle, the previous tent of meeting, the meeting place, they set up Levites or priests specifically to be continually singing praises of thanksgiving unto our God. And I'm convinced we have lost that attitude about us, let alone the practice of rendering thanksgiving to God. For the 372nd year, the wheels of commerce, at least for the most part, will come to a halt this coming Thursday in order for the American people to celebrate the Thanksgiving holiday. But in those 300 and plus years, what has this holiday turned into? The more years that are put between us and the first Thanksgiving celebration in 1623, the further it would appear that we depart from the real meaning and purpose of Thanksgiving. This probably couldn't be demonstrated any better or illustrated any better than how it's described in the latest Focus on the Family magazine. In an article entitled Let's Talk Turkey, I've clipped out and pasted in my notes here a part of what's stated therein, and it says, this is what I found there, quote, the National Association for the Education of Young People, which is composed of thousands of preschool and elementary teachers, publishes an anti-bias curriculum that attacks the holidays. For Thanksgiving, this organization encourages teachers to focus on the plight of Native Americans. The association suggests that teachers use the holiday to confront bias against the Indians. Quote within a quote. Talk about what is fair and unfair, what helps us learn about Native Americans, what hurts their feelings, end of quote, within a quote. In outlining her approach, a preschool program director in Pasadena, California, sent the following message to parents, quote, within a quote, to many Native American peoples today, Thanksgiving is a day of mourning because it is a reminder that in return for their help, knowledge, and tolerance of original European settlers, they were repaid with the theft of their land and the genocide of their people. End of quote within a quote and end of quote. Now, do you believe that? I'm not only asking, do you believe that that would be going in our nation? Obviously, we have digressed to the point where that is very possible, that our nation has digressed to that point. But do you believe that the average American Indian is in mourning come Thanksgiving Day? The only average American Indian that's going to do that is the one who's read that article by the National Association for the Education of Young Children. Unless they're programmed to think that way, they're not going to think that way. The author of this article then remarks, quote, Thanksgiving was never intended to be a history lesson about the quote-unquote invasion of the Pilgrims, and nowhere was it established to be a multicultural lesson about the plight of Native Americans, end of quote. Amen. And good for James Dotson for being brave enough to print this article, that which is not PI, or that which, excuse me, is PI, politically incorrect. And I would suspect he'll take some flat, and I hope he doesn't retract what's been stated in that article. Regrettably, it may not be very well known by many Americans in the 20th century, but as it was with the origins and purpose of this great nation, this holiday, in like manner, is Christian at its roots. It can be clearly seen from William Bradford's proclamation of November 29, 1623. Here is what he wrote. Inasmuch as the Great Father, what Great Father was he speaking of? Inasmuch as the Great Father has given us this year an abundant harvest of Indian corn, wheat, beans, squashes, and garden vegetables, and has made the forest to abound with game and the sea with fish and clams, and inasmuch as he has protected us from the ravages of the savages, has spared us from the pestilence and disease, has granted us freedom to worship God according to the dictates of our own consciences, now I, your magistrate, do proclaim that all ye pilgrims, with your wives and little ones, do gather at ye meeting house on ye hill between the hours of 9 and 12 in the daytime. Well, you guys think I preach long. In the daytime, on Thursday, November ye 29th of the year of our Lord, 1623, in the third year since ye pilgrims landed on ye pilgrim rock, there to listen to ye pastor, and render thanksgiving to ye Almighty God for all his blessings. End of that quote by William Bradford, governor of the colony of Plymouth. It can certainly be seen that at its very roots, at its very inception, it was intended to be a Christian holiday, one in which Christian men and women, Christian Americans, render their thanksgiving unto God. It was not so much a holiday as it was a holy day. It's interesting to see how that term, that's what holiday really was meant to be understood to mean, a holy day. And yet for Americans today, it's just a holiday. It's no longer a holy day. And yet it was intended to be a holy day, set aside to render thanks to Yahweh for the blessings secured from him through the previous year. But what is it now? What is Thanksgiving now? In comparison to what we find in Governor Bradford's proclamation in 1623. Just another, for the most part, just another commercialized holiday like Christmas and Easter. You know, in some regards, it's not even that good because they'd just as soon pass right over Thanksgiving, wouldn't they? It's amazing. Even now at Halloween, before Halloween, they're putting up Christmas decorations. But it's just, for the most part, it's just become another commercialized holiday. A holiday versus a holiday. A turkey day versus a day of Thanksgiving. When growing up in my home, Thanksgiving was a special day. But special for what reason? What was it? It was an extra day off of work or school, for which we were thankful. But thankful to whom? Certainly not necessarily God. And it was a day, of course, it was special because it was a day of family reunion and a big feast. And it was, of course, special, we dare not forget, because of the big football games that were going to be played on that day. I do remember a lot of Thanksgiving holidays, and they were special in our family. But I do not remember them as days of thanksgiving unto our Lord, Maker, and Provider. I can't go back in my times as a child and remember that. Not that there wasn't a blessing upon the meal, you know, but it was just something that was done and it was taken care of in that one little small fashion. But there is no remembrance of that day being a holy day. I look back on it as being special only because it was a holiday. And nothing more. And what's especially grievous about that is that our family, I'm convinced, was not the exception, but the rule for 20th century families. It had digressed that far. In light of this, have you ever wondered how God must look upon our 20th century celebration of Thanksgiving? Well, I think that we're given a clue in the Old Testament scriptures of how he may look upon this particular holiday and the way we celebrate it. If you take your Bibles and turn to Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah chapter 1 and verses 11 through 15. Verse 11, he says, "What are your multiplied sacrifices to me?" Now keep in mind the context of when this passage was written. We're not talking about a Thanksgiving holiday. We're talking about within the context of when they were required to perform the feast days, when they were required sacrifices, sometimes even daily sacrifices, by their God. But listen to what he says in regard to that. Verse 11 again, he says, "What are your multiplied sacrifices to me?" says Yahweh. "I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed cattle, and I take no pleasure in the blood of bulls, lambs, or goats. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts? Bring your..." And who did require this trampling of his courts? Wasn't it Yahweh himself that required that? Indeed it was. And yet he said, who requires this of you? Verse 13, "Bring your worthless offerings no longer. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath, the calling of assemblies. I cannot endure iniquity in this solemn assembly. I hate your new moon festivals and your appointed feasts." And again, keep in mind, it was God who established them. Verse 14 again, "I hate your new moon festivals and your appointed feasts. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them." Verse 15, "So when you spread out your hands in prayer, I will hide my eyes from you. Yet even though you multiply prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are covered with blood." We find similar language to that in the book of Amos, Amos chapter 5. Amos 5, beginning with verse 21. Again, he says, I reject your festivals, nor do I delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer up to me burnt offerings and your grain offerings, I will not accept them, and I will not even look at the peace offerings of your fatlings. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not even listen to the sound of your harps." What happened? Why did God suddenly find their holy days, the very holy days that he himself had established, why did he suddenly find them repugnant to him? Well, I believe that the answer to that is found, at least partially, in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 7, where Yeshua himself said, he says, "And when you are praying, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles or as the heathen do, for they suppose that they will be heard for their many words." Israel's sacrifices, their feast days, etc., had become nothing but meaningless repetition, done by rote rather than from their hearts. It wasn't that God was saying, "Don't do this anymore, I've changed my mind." But it was the way they were doing it. It was from where it was coming from. And he says, "I don't want anything to do with it." You know, I'm sure he must have been thinking to himself, "I was hoping that when I established this Mosaic covenant, when you wouldn't do these things freely unto me, and when I forced you to do them, that it would bring you back to the heart attitude that I was wanting from you. That you would do it out of love, that you would do it out of your faith in me and your respect to me." Instead, they had turned it completely around once again. And isn't that exactly what the Thanksgiving holiday has degenerated into as well, at least in the majority of homes across this nation? A hollow holiday, just meaningless repetition for the most part, for most Americans, even most Christian Americans today, I venture to say. What's happened? What's happened to Thanksgiving? You know, some of our other major holidays are even questionable as to whether their roots are certainly questionable as far as being Christian. Roots, if you go back, trace them back far enough, they're really pagan, and they were just switched and changed and molded to try to fit Christianity who's the fellow back that converted to Christianity, the king. I lost his name. But so as he took the pagan holidays and mixed in Christianity with it. And so there's no question of that, but there's no question about Thanksgiving, that it is a Christian holiday. And look to what it's degenerated into in the modern 20th century. What's happened to Thanksgiving? In order to answer that question, we need to first ask or answer another question, because Thanksgiving is just, what's happened to Thanksgiving is just a symptom of a greater problem. What needs to be asked is what's happened to thankfulness. Again, I think, as I've already pointed out, I think that we've lost even the art of thankfulness. For not only has Americans lost the meaning of thanksgiving, but we've lost the art of giving thanks. In the remainder of this message, I would like to look at what's happened to the giving of thanks in order to understand what's happened to Thanksgiving. First, as ironic as it may seem, when prosperity is the rule rather than the exception, God, and again, as ironic as this may seem, it is certainly the truth. In those situations when prosperity is the rule rather than the exception, God is usually forgotten and thankfulness is lost. I don't know why it is, but abundance and gratitude usually don't share the same room, when you would think it would be just the opposite. Ancient Israel was warned of this very problem. If you'll turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy 6 and verses 10 through 12. In verse 10 it said, we find, "Then it shall come about, when Yahweh your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you shall eat and be satisfied." You'd think then they would be just ready to provide him all the thanksgiving that he could endure. But no, he says, when this has happened, when I take you into the Canaan land and give you all that's already been provided for you, all that's already been built up, all the cities, all the vineyards, all the farming preparations that's been done, so that you don't even have to start from scratch. He says, verse 12, "Then watch yourselves, lest you forget Yahweh, who brought you from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall fear only Yahweh your God, and you shall worship and swear by his name." In light of this, regrettably, the blessings of Abraham actually became a curse to his descendants when his descendants failed to recognize them as coming from the hand of Yahweh. Pastor Cotton Mather, one of the early great American pastors in this land, once put it this way, quote, "Religion begat prosperity, and the daughter devoured the mother." Let me read it to you again. It says, "Religion," he wrote, "religion begat prosperity, and the daughter devoured the mother." End of quote. It's true, thankfulness is rare at times of abundance. On the other hand, it abounds, again, as a general rule, it abounds in times of need and desperation. Starve your dog for a week. See if it's not true. It'll take one little small scrap of meat to get more thankfulness out of that dog than you've probably experienced in all the times of prosperity. Look at Israel's history. Israel repeatedly rejected God, and nearly always, if you go back and read the history, in times of great prosperity, rarely in times of poverty. Turn to Hosea chapter 10. Hosea chapter 10 and verse 1. Listen, it says, "Israel is a luxuriant vine. He produces fruit for himself." And then listen, "The more his fruit, the more altars he made. The richer his land, the better he made the sacred pillars." Also go to chapter 13 and verse 6. Verse 6, it says, as they had their pasture, they became satisfied. And being satisfied, their heart became proud. Therefore, they forgot me. It was during the times, again, it's ironic that it's that way. But it's in the times of greatest abundance that we tend to forget our God and lose the ability to be thankful. Peter Marshall and David Manuel wrote of the same thing happening here in America with the second generation Americans. In the book, The Light and the Glory, on pages 213 and 214, after quoting Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 11 through 14 and verses 17 through 19, which is a passage very similar to the one I just quoted to you from Deuteronomy 6, they wrote this, quote, "And this was exactly what was beginning to happen in God's new Israel over here in America. Just one generation after the arrival of the first comers, for faith was not something that could be passed on from generation to generation or imparted by baptism or the partaking of the Holy Communion. In order for faith to come to flower, it must be planted in the soil of gratitude. But being born into town situations," again, very similar to what happened with Israel over in Canaan land, "but being born into town situations, instead of having to carve them out of the wilderness, the succeeding generations would not know desperate need. They would grow up never knowing that it meant to be persecuted, what it meant to be persecuted for one's faith, to be mocked and scorned or even imprisoned merely because they loved God enough to attempt to put Him and His will before all else. The sons of the fathers would never know what it was like to have no land and no work and no say in how they were governed. They would have no indelible memories etched into their minds of 10, 12, 16 weeks of wet misery on the open seas, of living in tents or holes in the ground, while cold and sickness took one and two, of starving times which saw them on their hands and knees looking for ground nuts or grubbing for mussels to stay alive, and all for the sake of their combined faith in the vision of a promised land. Therefore, they would not be inclined to put all their trust in God. It was by His grace that they and their parents were being blessed, and while they might give lip service to His grace, the truth was that since they had never known anything else, they could hardly share the gratefulness of their parents. In times of need, even the smallest blessings are appreciated." I think I've used this before, but I think it states it well. "After a week of beans and taters, even a change to taters and beans is good." The prophet Habakkuk exhibited this as well. Turn to Habakkuk, one of those hard-to-find books in the Old Testament. Habakkuk, just before Zephaniah. Of course, Zephaniah isn't that easy to find either. Just after Nahum, there's another hard one. It's down in those hard-to-find ones. But Habakkuk certainly exhibited this attitude of even appreciating the smallest of blessings, or when you have nothing, still being thankful. Habakkuk chapter 3 in verses 17 and 18. Verse 17, listen to what he says. He says, "Though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls," what would you think would be the result? With Habakkuk and the people of God, it was different than what you'd expect, because he says, "Yet I will exalt in Yahweh. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation." Why? Verse 19. "The Lord Yahweh is my strength, and He has made my feet like hinds' feet, and makes me walk on high places." You see, Habakkuk, even in the toughest of times, and boy, you look back on those Old Testament prophets' lives, men like Jeremiah especially, and the others, and the persecution, the times they went through, times of starvation, not because even the land was starving, but simply because they were prophets of God who weren't willing to compromise the truths of God. Sometimes thrown in pits or wells, left there starving until somebody merciful enough would throw down rags to bring them up again, like it was in the case of Jeremiah. And Habakkuk, I'm sure, was one of those as well, who had lived during the worst of times. And yet it's still, even with that, he did not prove to be an unthankful servant, steward.
Instead, he found the ability to thank God because he knew all of those things meant nothing as long as he had his God and what God could bless and give him. It's the same that's found in the true Christian spirit. Turning to the New Testament, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. These are two, and I've used these at different times before, but these two passages in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and 2 Corinthians chapter 6. There are two, and I know you wonder how many favorite passages I have because I keep mentioning favorite passages. But these are two of my favorite passages. And if anything ever described what Christianity is truly meant to be, these are it. And it flies in the face of these prosperity preachers that we have on television today, that if you give to me, if you give to my ministry, God's going to bless you and you'll never have any pains, woes, or cares. It flies in the face of that. This describes what Christianity really is and was really meant to be. In 2 Corinthians, beginning in chapter 4 and verse 8, listen to this. It says, Paul writes, we are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not despairing. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. And then jumping over to chapter 6, in almost the same language, he says, regarded as deceivers, yet true, as unknown, yet well known, as dying, yet behold we live, as punished, and yet not put to death, as sorrowful, yet always rejoicing, as poor, yet making many rich, as having nothing, and yet possessing all things. That's the spirit of Christianity. You talk about gratitude in times of desperation and need. And we may be going into some of those times in the future. Though there seems to be a small window of opportunity right now for true Christianity to take advantage of, when people's eyes are beginning to open and ears are beginning to open as well, to be able to see once again just a little bit of light, being able to hear again just a little bit of truth. And it's an opportunity that we have, but if we lose that opportunity that I believe that we do have right now, we may be facing some of the worst of times as they did then. But they certainly understood what it meant in the first century as Christians. You know, every other religion under the sun was tolerated except for this one, the one called the Way or Christianity. Why? Because they told the truth. And they weren't necessarily politically correct in the first century AD any more than what we preach and believe and teach is politically correct in the 20th century. And because of that, they certainly lived in times of desperation and need. And yet look, what Christianity, what Christ Himself provided for them, the attitude, the heart attitude. And there was nothing said there of gratefulness. There was nothing there said of thankfulness. And yet you can see it just coming out of the pores of what Paul writes there. And that's why I love it so much. Certainly there have been and should be exceptions to the rule, as also demonstrated by the Apostle Paul. Turn to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians 4, and verse, beginning with verse 11. He says, "Now that I, not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am." Not just, he wasn't just thankful in the times of need. But he said, in whatever circumstances I happen to be at the time, I have learned how to be content. Going on, he says, I know how to get along with humble means. Certainly Paul knew how to do that, living in the dungeon, living many years of his life in the dungeon of a prison. And I also know how to live in prosperity in any and every circumstance. And he knew how to live in prosperity as well. There was even a time when imprisoned by Felix that Felix was bringing him into his presence, hoping that Paul would bestow money to him. He must have been a very wealthy man at times. And so he says again in verse 12, I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity in any and every circumstance. I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. There are certainly exceptions to the rule. It doesn't have to be that only during times of need and desperation that we are thankful. Paul knew how to be thankful whether the times were good or the times were bad. And certainly with that is an example for us. Yet usually, thankfulness is lost with prosperity. And so it is with most Americans today. Because of their great prosperity. Prosperity in many cases that have been handed down to them one generation after from another. They have lost their vision of God and who He is. And that He is the one that has made it all possible. Whether it came from generations before or in their generation. Secondly, disobedience is also a cause of ingratitude. When Israel, both ancient Israel and modern Israel found in the Celto-Saxon peoples today, becomes disobedient to her Maker's laws, there is actually little to be thankful for. Because obedience to God's laws obedience to God's laws was designed to furnish blessings. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy 4 and verses 39 and 40. Verse 39, it says, "Know therefore today, and take it into your heart, that Yahweh, He is God in heaven above, and on the earth below there is no other." Verse 40, "So you shall keep His statutes and His commandments, which I am giving you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may live long in the land which Yahweh your God is giving you for all time." Joshua, and also Joshua chapter 1 and verse 8, where it says, "This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you shall make your way prosperous, and then you shall have success." God made it so that it would be that when we're obedient to His laws, His commandments, statutes, and judgments, that blessings would proceed from it beyond our estimation. Also, Deuteronomy chapter 11, verses 26 through 28. Moses writes, "See, I am setting before you today," or actually he writes what God is saying, "See, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you listen to the commandments of Yahweh your God, which I am commanding you today, and the curse if you do not listen to the commandments which I am commanding you today by following other gods which you have not known." A blessing for obedience, a curse for disobedience. Most of us know that the blessings and curses, depending on whether we're obedient or disobedient to God's laws, are detailed for us in great detail in Deuteronomy chapter 28. I won't read that for you. You can do that on your own because there's so much there. But let me enumerate some of the results of obedience and disobedience to God's laws. For example, obedience to God's food and health laws results in health and longevity, whereas disobedience to those same laws results in sickness, disease, and death. Obedience to God's agricultural laws results in great nutritional value in the food products, whereas disobedience to those same laws results in low to no nutritional food values, such as a result from pesticides and herbicides, and especially from hybridization, which is against God's law. Obedience to God's social laws results in peace and tranquility, whereas disobedience to God's social law results in tension, hatred, race wars. Obedience to God's moral laws results in happy marriages, fidelity, and health. Whereas disobedience to God's health laws results in infertility, disease, and divorce. Obedience to God's economic laws results in prosperity and freedom. Whereas disobedience to God's economic laws results in poverty and bondage. Obedience to God's civil and judicial laws results in justice and low crime rates. Whereas disobedience to God's civil and judicial laws results in corruption and high crime rates. And disobedience to God's military laws results in strength, victory, and highly regarded. Whereas disobedience to God's military laws results in weakness, defeat, and being despised. Now let me ask you, which better represents America today? The curses.
But what's especially sad about our state is that our slavery has been effectuated so ingeniously upon our people over a slow, very gradual period of time that most Americans would believe that we are best represented today by the blessing side, when it's just the opposite. Most Americans think that we're free. And yet here in the so-called, what used to be the land of the free, you can go to prison today for picking up feathers. I don't know if you saw the program a couple weeks ago on 60 Minutes or 2020 or one of those news programs. And there was a woman who had picked up feathers around her house and made a Indian dream catcher for Hillary Clinton. Didn't go to prison, but was on 5 years probation with thousands of dollar fine to her, and could have gone to prison had they so decided to do so, for simply picking up feathers. And this is the land of the free. And that's just one bizarre example, but that shows how far we have gotten, and yet most people think that we're a free nation. A nation that many of our forefathers died and bled for. And yet we've handed it over to the enslavers of this country. That's how far it's gone, how bad it's gotten. It's a fact. America today is more cursed than blessed because of her disobedience to God's laws. And I think part of the problem is that each generation goes along and gets further and further from the way it used to be. We really have nothing to compare it with. And especially when the media and the government is telling that we're so blessed, and that we're still the land of the free and the home of the brave. And we have nothing to compare it with to see just how bad it is. And we've been so mesmerized by Hollywood and TV and so brainwashed that we think it's one way when it's the other way. Consequently, what perfect slaves we make as well. You know, we're happy slaves, so we think we have it so good. But when you start contrasting, what we have today with what our forefathers had centuries ago, there is no comparison. And we need to return to the way it was. It's a fact, as I've already said, that America is more cursed than blessed because of her disobedience to God's laws. We are a country, a nation of people in disobedience to God's laws. Agricultural, health, food laws, civil laws, military laws, you name it. We're in disobedience. And so we have to be. Unless our God is not true to His word, we are a cursed people. And it gets worse as each generation, or even now, as each year goes by, it becomes worse. Thus, there's not a lot to be thankful for. Not that we still shouldn't be thankful, but there's really not a lot to be thankful for in comparison to the way it's been in the past. Hosea 4 certainly describes the situation well. It's a passage, at least one of these verses you're all familiar with, but we don't always read it with the verse that follows. In Hosea chapter 4, in verse 6, it says, "My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge." How much more so when the knowledge they lack is the knowledge of the situation they're currently in. "My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge, because you have rejected knowledge. I also reject you from being my priest. Since you have forgotten the law of your God, I will also forget your children." And then verse 7 says, "The more they multiplied, the more they sinned against me. I will change their glory into shame." Indeed, it describes our situation well. Not only does Israel's disobedience leave Israel with little to be thankful for, but it also leads to a more thankless world as well. For when Israel is obedient to Yahweh's laws, she is blessed, and then is a blessing to the rest of the world. America has been in that state before. She is no longer there now. Is America today consider a blessing or a curse by the rest of the world? This isn't knowledge that's necessarily real available out there as well, but you can see it more and more. Look at how the other nations, contrast how the other nations used to view America. Everyone wanted to be like America.
We're now the majority of the world, and it's not brought out very much in the news, across the news media sources. But now look at how they look upon America and Americans. Are we considered a blessing or a curse? That's really a gauge on Israel's obedience. Because when we're in obedience to God's laws, we are blessed and we become a blessing to the rest of the world. When we're in disobedience, we are cursed. And consequently, we also become a curse to the rest of the world as well. Thirdly, godlessness is a cause of ingratitude. When God is removed from society, then thankfulness loses its meaning, for then there is no one to be thankful to but self. President Abraham Lincoln recognized this problem even in his day. On October 3, 1863, he issued the following National Thanksgiving Proclamation. Quote, "We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us. And we have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to pray to the God that made us." End of that quote. And I might add, to thank him for the bounties bestowed. If that was true then, how much more so today? The 20th century has provided us with the Humanist Manifesto, which audaciously proclaims, quote, "No deity will save us. We must save ourselves," end of quote. And that has engendered the Frank Sinatra and the Elvis Presley mentalities of, "I did it my way." Yeah, they did it their way, and look where it's gotten them or is getting them. And it's engendered the motivational speakers such as Dennis Waitley with his course entitled The Psychology of Winning, with its 10 major points of positive self-expectation, positive self-motivation, self-image, self-direction, self-control, self-discipline, self-esteem, self-dimension, self-awareness, and positive self-projection. Where's God in the picture? He's left out. Because in the mind of so many today, in the 20th century, no deity can save us. We must save ourselves. And God is out of the picture. Israel, we need to be reminded of the fact that without Yahweh, we are nothing. Deuteronomy chapter 8, a passage that was quoted in The Light and the Glory. I didn't read it then because I wanted to read it now. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Once again, we need to be reminded that without Yahweh, without our Savior, Yeshua the Christ, we are nothing. Deuteronomy chapter 8, reading beginning with verse 11, it says, "Beware lest you forget Yahweh your God by not keeping His commandments and His ordinances and His statutes, which I am commanding you today. Lest when you have eaten and are satisfied and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and gold multiply, and all that you have multiplies, then your heart becomes proud." How similar to what Abraham Lincoln penned in his day. "Then your heart becomes proud, and you forget Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. He led you..." Stopping there and then picking it up with verse 17. And he says, "Otherwise you may say in your heart, my power and strength..." Self-image, self-control, self-esteem, self-awareness, self-motivation, self-direction, so forth and so on. "Otherwise, you may say in your heart, my power and strength and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. But you shall remember Yahweh your God, for it is He who is giving you power to make wealth, that He may confirm His covenant which He swore to your fathers, as it is this day. And it shall come about, if you ever forget Yahweh your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you today that you shall surely perish. Like the nations that Yahweh makes to perish before you, so you shall perish, because you would not listen to the voice of Yahweh your God. You know, it's an alarming fact of history that most nations, from their inception to their destruction, usually last 200 years. We're beyond that. And maybe we're pushing the envelope. And we will be pushing the envelope unless our people return and leave their false gods and return to the one who's made this nation and all that we have possible. Didn't James claim the same? In James chapter 1 and verse 17, he wrote, every good thing bestowed and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. The Apostle Paul as well, in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, chapter 9 and beginning with verse 6, he says, "Now this I say, he who sows sparingly shall also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully shall also reap bountifully. Let each one do just as he has proposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver." And then he says, "And God is able to make all grace abound." Somebody may say, "Well, man, I can't afford to give bountifully. I can't afford to be gracious. I just can't afford it." You know the times we live in. But listen to what God says then, or what Paul writes. It says, "And God is able to make all grace abound to you, that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. As it is written, he who scattered abroad, he gave to the poor. His righteousness abides forever. Now he who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but it is also overflowing through many thanksgiving to God. Every good gift is bestowed from the Father above. And even when we think we can't afford to be bountiful, to be giving, to be gracious, he said, test me. I'll give you more than you can give. Now, I've tested him. He's proven it true. One of the identifying marks for Israel today is that of knowing Yahweh. A people who know Yahweh, a people who have it naturally within them to know that Yahweh is their God, the God of the Scriptures, rather than Buddha or Krishna or who, whatever other God there may be out there that the most of the rest of the pagan nations worship. One of the identifying marks of Israel is that they may be led into believing in some of those gods, but naturally they understand that their God is Yahweh. And so one of the identifying marks of modern Israel is those people who know God, who know Yahweh, as described in Hebrews chapter 8 and verses 8, 10, and 11, where we find a description, a specific description of the new covenant itself. Verse 8, we all know, if we're finding fault with them, he says, "Behold, days are coming, says Yahweh, when I will effect a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." And then describing the covenant, in verse 10 it says, "For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Yahweh. I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them upon their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach everyone his fellow citizen and everyone his brethren, saying, know Yahweh. For all shall know me, from the least to the greatest of them." It's one of the identifying marks of who Israel is today. And with that, and the many other identifying traits, the Celto-Saxon people are easily identified as being Israel. However, the opposite of that passage is just as true as well. That is, that when the Celto-Saxon people forget their roots, they also often lose sight of their God. And when they lose sight of their God, they know not whom to thank for their blessings. Hosea chapter 2, one of the last passages we'll look at. Hosea chapter 2 in verses 1 through 8. He says, "Say to your brothers, Ami, and to your sisters, Rohama, Contend with your mother, contend, for she is not my wife, dealing with the house of Israel after God had divorced the house of Israel. For she is not my wife, and I am no longer her husband, and let her put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and expose her on the day when she was born. I will also make her like a wilderness, make her like a desert land, and slay her with thirst. And I will have no compassion on her children, because they are children of harlotry. For their mother has played the harlot. She who conceived them has acted shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers, and will give my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Therefore, behold, and by the way, it is speaking of the house of Israel there, but it's using the terminology of adultery and harlotry in reference to her idolatry. God had been her husband. And he says, you're adulterous because you go after other gods, other husbands. And so God says in verse 6, therefore, behold, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. In other words, there would be a loss of identity. And then it says, and she will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them. And she will seek them, but will not find them. And then she will say, I will go back to my first husband, for it is better for me then than now. And then verse 8, for she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine, and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. He says, you've lost sight of me, because you've even lost sight of yourself and who you are. What was true then, regretfully, is still true today in far, far too many cases. Has America become prosperous, disobedient, and godless? Indeed she has, and as a result, she is no longer grateful to her God. As I've pointed out in previous messages, ingratitude is the beginning of the road to degradation. I won't read it, but you can do it for your own. Romans chapter 1 and verses 18 through 25. There's probably not a better description of the evolution process of from righteousness to total degradation. The point of homosexuality and so forth as it's described in that passage. But where did it begin? It began, if you read the passage, by not acknowledging God for who He is and their lack of gratitude toward Him. Ingratitude is at least part of the beginning of the road to degradation. Paul also wrote us in writing Timothy. In 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verses 1 and 5, he said, but realize this, that in the last days difficult times will come. For men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, holding to a form of godliness. And this, of course, that's where many of our churches are today. Holding to a form of godliness, although they deny its power and avoid such men as these. Thankfulness must be restored. The Apostle Paul wrote, rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in the Christ Yeshua. In everything give thanks. Paul meant what he wrote. Here's just a partial list of the things for which he gave thanks. Things that we could give thanks for. Daily food, 1 Corinthians 10, 30 and 31. The love and care of fellow Christians, Romans 16, 3 and 4. Salvation of the lost, Colossians 1, 3 and 5. His own call to the ministry, 1 Timothy 1 and verse 12. Converts abounding in faith and love, 1 Thessalonians 1, 2 and 3. His co-workers, 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 16. God's provision of victory, 2 Corinthians 2 and verse 14. For His own salvation, Colossians chapter 1 and verse 12. For God's unspeakable gift, Yeshua the Messiah, 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 15. And the final victory over death and the grave, 1 Corinthians 5 verses 55 through 57. And if that wasn't enough, for all things, Ephesians 5 and verse 20. The streamer, Lady Elgin, was thinking it was a chilly evening in early September. She was brilliantly lighted and loaded with excursionists. She had almost reached Chicago, but before help could arrive, she would be gone. The crowd on the shore watched the tragedy, powerless to help. but not all of them were helpless. Two brothers, students in a theological seminary, plunged through the crowd with a rope in their hands. Nat the elder, a powerful man and a trained swimmer, leaped into the waves. Inch by inch, he fought his way through until he reached the ship and climbed aboard. A moment later, he plunged back with a woman in his arms. The crowd hauled him in, choking and cold but still strong. Again he plunged in, and again and again. 17 women and children he brought to the shore. At last he sank exhausted. Still the cries rang in his ears. After a few minutes he raised himself and again plunged in. Again and again. 23 human lives Nat Spencer saved before his strength entirely left him. For weeks he lay delirious. The 23 whom he had saved scattered to their homes. The bodies of the 300 who were lost had been tossed up by the waves. The nation had begun to forget the tragedy. But the 23 whom he had saved, surely they did not forget. Surely they were grateful. This is a simple truth. Not one of them ever came back to thank Nat Spencer for what he had done. Not one of them even wrote him a letter. Nat Spencer went out into life as an invalid, having given his strength for 23 people who did not so much as say thank you. One hears that story or reads that story and they can't help but think of the 10 lepers healed by Christ. And only one returned to thank him. Let me ask you, are you one of the 9? Or are you the one who turned back? Surely we should express our gratitude by word and by deed to the one who gave his life in order that we might have forgiveness and life eternal. If we are ever to restore the true meaning of thanksgiving, we must first restore the art of giving thanks. I greatly anticipate, I look forward to when the identity of Israel is reclaimed as a whole, so that as a nation we will once again, as a nation, I know we may do it individually, but as a nation we will once again render genuine thanksgiving unto our God. Let it be so with our homes this Thanksgiving holiday. And every day it needs to be so. Let it begin even now. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer.